You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Podsafe the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, is very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
This season of Desert Island Dishes is sponsored by Cook's Matches. Cook's Matches have been the mainstay of British kitchens for over 40 years and remain the match for both cooks and chefs to use in the kitchen. You will have seen those iconic yellow boxes in just about anybody who's anybody's kitchen. This autumn, they're running an amazing giveaway to help you fall in love with cooking. In order to be in with a chance to win an incredible cookware bundle consisting of a set of kitchen knives, apron, oven gloves, and a signed Tom Kerridge Hand and Flowers cookbook, they want to hear about your favourite cozy autumn dish. It's very simple to enter. All you have to do is follow Cook's Matches on Instagram, like the post on their page which tells you about the giveaway, and then simply leave a comment with your favourite autumn meal. I mean, to be honest, that's going to be the hardest bit. Narrowing down your favourite dish to just one, but you can do it. The competition runs until the 28th of October, so get entering. To find out more, head to the website www.cooksmatches.co.uk. Good luck to everyone, and thank you very much to Cook's Matches. Hi, I'm Margie Namora, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the podcast where every week I ask my guests to choose their 7 Desert Island dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. I hope you're all well and that you've had a lovely week. Now, I know that I told you a few weeks ago about pressing the wrong button and how it would never happen again. Well, you know where this is going, don't you? I only went and did it again. Honestly, after 100 episodes or so, you would think that I would have got the hang of this recording malarkey, but here we are. I think it was also a combination of me pressing something I shouldn't have, probably when I was chatting, and then also the fact that there were 3 of us. And so this is definitely a friendly, chatty conversation where there are some overlaps in when people are talking. But hopefully you get a rapport and it feels like you are part of the conversation with these 2 lovely sisters. I am still very much a one-man band, and it's lovely when people think that there is a team behind helping me. That hasn't been the case up until now, but with all of these mistakes I seem to be making, maybe the universe is trying to tell me something. Anyway, on with today's episode, which is with the wonderful Rangoon sisters. I've been wanting to talk to them for ages as their story is really inspiring, and I love that they've done all of this as a side hustle. And more than a side hustle, all of it goes to charity. They don't profit from the Rangoon sisters, which I think is very admirable. We recorded this several weeks ago and they very generously sent me some lapet to try, which is a classic and very delicious Burmese dish. The lapet was accompanied by the following message, and with the situation ever-changing in Burma, I felt it was really important to include.
Hi, Margie. It was so nice to see you the other day. I hope that you enjoy the lapet that we've sent you. So lapet is the pickled tea leaf that is really unique to Burmese cuisine. It looks a bit green and mulchy, but it's really delicious. It has slight acidity, slight bitterness. It really is a unique flavour, but it goes really well if you mix it with the crunchy beans and nuts and garlic. And you can also add some sliced cabbage and tomato for a bit of freshness. Chili is good, a bit of garlic oil and a bit of lime. Fish sauce can also add a bit of saltiness. So I really hope you enjoy it. As we mentioned, it is something that's typically eaten at the end of a meal. It's got a bit of a caffeine hit, which is great. And historically, it was often consumed at the sort of settlement of disputes. And as you know, obviously, the situation in Burma is really tragic and upsetting with the military coup. And then if you add on top the situation with the COVID wave. If any of your listeners would like to find out more about ways they can help and places that we can recommend to donate, then they can go to our Instagram page, which is instagram.com/Rangoon Sisters. And there's a link and you can find out more. Take care.
Thank you so much for that, Emily. And now here is today's episode. My guests today are Emily and Amy Chung, aka the Rangoon Sisters. These two sisters are junior doctors by day, cooks by night, as they host sellout supper clubs as part of their mission to put Burmese food on the culinary map. The sisters started their supper club in 2013 after visiting Burma for the first time in 2012, and have since gone on to raise over £10,000 for charities since then. Their number one fan is Grace Dent, who said that their mohinga, the fish chowder, was the nicest thing she put in her mouth in 2017. Grace Dent has said, "As a restaurant critic, I constantly giggle at their humble manner of serving some of the best food I've ever eaten. It's always brought to the table with the words, 'This probably isn't very good, but see if you like it.'" They brought out their debut cookbook last year to critical acclaim. It was in the Observer Food Monthly top 10 books of 2020. Steeped in family recipes and stories which are well written and easy to follow, it's not hard to see why it's been such a hit. Emily has said, "We are always nervous that we can pull this off again, but then the empty plates come back to the kitchen and we think, well, at some level we're doing okay." Welcome, Emily and Amy.
Thank you. That was a really nice introduction.
Yes, thanks for having us. No, you're so welcome. So those quotes by Grace Dent are pretty amazing. Do you take that kind of thing in your stride, or are you often pinching yourselves that it's actually happened?
I mean, I think definitely we're still in shock at how sort of people have received us. And having a quote like that from Grace Dent is obviously amazing. You know, she's so well respected in the country, so... Yeah, I still don't believe it, actually, sometimes.
Yeah, still pinching ourselves years later.
And the fact that she said not only do you make some of the best food she's ever eaten, but also that you're incredibly humble about it. I mean, that's just the best combination that you can get in a person, really, isn't it?
I think we were laughing when you were saying that, because I think that is actually, that really sums us up, probably.
I think I'm always like, I don't think things,
no.
Am I doing this good enough? That will always be in the back of my mind.
Every time we cook, we're always like, is this, I don't know if they'll like it.
what's the phrase? Under promise, over deliver. And then no one kind of disappointed. And so I'm guessing that she came to one of your supper clubs. How did that initially come about?
She did come to one of our supper clubs and she'd invited us to take part in London Food Month prior to that, but she hadn't actually had much of our food, so we just invited her over for dinner and she came, and it was quite funny because she said that actually people didn't really ever invite her to their homes for dinner. It was always a case of them inviting her out or going somewhere to eat, so it's kind of novel to be in someone's home and fed food.
That's very brave of you.
Yeah.
I don't know. Where did that come from? Maybe there is some confidence somewhere, but I think
we wanted to kind of pay her back for being supportive.
So nice.
And what better way than have someone over to your home and
cook for
feed
them
lots of food.
The dream. And the fact that you both have full-time jobs and working as doctors, no less,
the Rangoon Sisters is something that you do on the side. I mean, that's just incredible. And to be honest, puts the rest of us to shame. Would you describe yourselves as overachievers? And just to preface that by saying, I double checked the meaning of an overachiever. And the phrase is definitely a compliment. And it's people who do great things, but they're constantly striving to accomplish more.
Okay. I don't know. I hate to agree with that, but I guess that probably is the case. I mean, I think since we were very young, I think we were always encouraged to do a lot. So I think particularly our mum always wanted us to do lots of things. And so I think it was sort of instilled in us from a young age. And I think, you know, obviously we both practiced medicine and then doing the supper clubs, I think obviously we saw it as a challenge, but also something we really enjoy as well. Mm-hmm. And I think people are always surprised about how we managed to do it alongside everything else. But I think actually it ends up being quite easy sometimes and quite effortless, because I think we just enjoy cooking and we love the food as well. So
I mean, I think when you apply to do medicine, you have to be kind of this all-rounder that does lots of things and participate in team and music and so on, and we were encouraged to do that. And actually now I look back and think, you know, God, we were so privileged to be given those opportunities by our parents. And so this is kind of just an extension of that, I guess. What's built in now is we want to try and do our best and do as many things as we can to as high a standard as we can. So, yeah. And it's about work-life balance as well, because actually, you know, you can easily get burnt out in any job. And it's nice to have something completely different, a different outlet that is hard work. Cooking is hard work. I don't know how people do it full time. It's so difficult. But, you know, it's fun at the same time. Hmm.
Yeah, I definitely think we're very lucky that we're in a, you know, really great position where we can do the cooking as well. And we have so much fun.
And you both work for the NHS. One of you is a psychiatrist and the other as a sexual health consultant. Did you both grow up wanting to be doctors from a young age, or did you ever consider working in food?
No. I love my job, by the way, but I'm the one that does sexual health. And I was good at science and maths, and then, you know, you kind of think about what career options there are for you. And I was going to do a science degree, but then I realized I was missing out on that kind of interaction that you get in medicine. But I wouldn't say it was kind of my life's goal from childhood. You know, I really want to be a doctor and I really want to help people. It just kind of happened that way, that's, you know, science and wanting to interact with people, well, medicine. And actually, it's brilliant. I never for once would have considered doing food. I don't know, Amy. I think
that, yeah, it's the same for me as well. It wasn't that dream from you know, childhood saying, I dream to be a doctor one day. No, it wasn't anything like that. But obviously, I'm, you know, equally happy to have ended up in that career, and I really enjoy it, and I'm so glad that it's happened. I guess thinking about our parents and what they were, I mean, obviously our parents would have wanted us to do something that was secure and was going to pay well. I think, but my dad, I remember, was saying, why do you want to be a doctor like your sister? You should do something like business or something like that.
Isn't every parent going to have two daughters?
That's what you think. But I remember he was like, why do you want to do that? Why do you want to do the same thing as your sister?
I mean, talking about dad questioning like our choices, I mean, obviously he was happy at the end, but, you know, even with when we started to do supper clubs and get involved in food, he would privately ask our mum, I don't know why they're doing this, because it doesn't earn them any money. Like, what is the purpose? Mm. But then by the, you know, as time went by, he could see how enjoyable it was, and he would volunteer to help out. And it was really nice by the end. And he kind of see that there are other reasons to do
this. Yes. Yes. Not just the financial gain.
So you say that your parents definitely had a big influence on you. Your dad was Hong Kong Chinese and your mother Burmese, and they were both really into food and the cuisines that they grew up with, but they also felt really strongly about you trying lots of different things. So let's talk about the first desert island dish, and that's the dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
I would choose wonton, so, you know, the squares of pastry, wonton pastry that you fill with meat or veg, and then you fold them up. And what we would do is for parties, we would kind of all get together with our dad and our mom and make them all together. And it would be kind of a contest as to how many we could each fold up and how many would be a disaster. And then what we would do is fry, what my dad would do is he would deep fry them, and then they'd be really nice and crispy. and usually served with sweet and sour sauce. Then if you had excess, you could kind of boil them up and have them in a soup. So plain bit of soup, spring onion. Usually the filling would be a bit of minced pork, really simple minced pork, white pepper, and maybe a bit of spring onion. That was all. Really, really easy to make. But just many, many evenings making those together and then serving them up to guests. That's kind of my strong childhood memory.
Yeah. So delicious. When you say when you have excess, first of all, did you often have excess?
You can answer. I mean, yes. That's I guess that's another sort of memory of childhood and sort of being at home. But it was that we'd often, so our parents would often entertain their friends. And whenever that would happen, you knew you were going to have a feast. And everyone always remembers those sort of days when you speak to them now, all the family friends, of when you'd have like dish after dish coming out of the kitchen like a conveyor belt and the sort of dining table just full of lots of dishes. And it would always be like a variety of things, because obviously our parents have different heritage. So, yeah, Dad would bring out the wontons. You'd have like roast duck. You'd have Burmese curry and some noodle dishes and just... it was amazing. Just all those memories of everyone just tucking in and, you know, obviously going for seconds and thirds, etc.
But mandatory. <isn't> So for anyone listening who might not be familiar with Burmese food, I think when asked this before, you've said that your dishes of bold curries and super salads are similar to other Asian styles of cooking, but they have more flavour. Is that how you describe it?
Well, that's a bit of a controversial thing to say, more flavour.
I think... yeah, definitely. If you're not familiar, it's reminiscent of lots of other similar Southeast Asian cuisines, you know, in Thailand and Malaysia. But yeah, I think there's kind of textures to a lot of dishes, particularly the salads. So they're maybe soft and crunchy, but also you know, sour elements, sweet elements, spicy elements. So it's kind of that combination of lots of textures and tastes. There can be a lot of intensity from things like fermented shrimp paste and fermented flavours in fish. And yeah, it's not necessarily kind of blow out spicy heat.
I guess in Burmese food, it's not necessarily, you know, very spicy like maybe Thai food is. It's a bit, you know, it's a bit more fragrant, I guess, the spicing that you get. And I guess another thing about Burmese food is that often when you know, sharing all the dishes, you often have some condiments on the side and you'll have extra chili oil or, you know, extra fish sauce or limes and things like that. So you can tailor it to what you sort of prefer. And we always have those things on the table because, you know, sometimes you do like things a bit more spicy or maybe you don't. So it's flexible.
Oh, such a nice way of eating. So it's sort of familiar flavours, but using them in a different way and perhaps a different combination that people might be used to.
Yeah, I think so.
I think I also read... but a common thread is that every dish will have at least three of the five tastes of salty, sweet, sour, bitter, and unon. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, definitely true. One always trying to get that balance, I think.
And you are obviously champions of Burmese food and feel passionately about spreading the word. But surely not enough people have tried Burmese food. And why do you think that is?
Well, it's partly because there aren't necessarily that many restaurants, certainly in this country. I mean, until... not that long ago, there was only one in London, and now there are two or three, and there are more sort of supper clubs and pop-ups doing Burmese food.
There is a big Burmese population.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So why is that?
I suppose until fairly recently, people weren't travelling there so much, and I suppose now that, or maybe prior to what's been happening recently, people were travelling there more and kind of there was more knowledge and experience spreading about it. But it's doubt, as you say, there are lots of Burmese people here, or people from Burma, and the food is being cooked and being eaten, but not necessarily, I guess, in the mainstream.
Shared with the public. But I think also people are definitely a lot more adventurous, I think, and people have a lot more varied, I don't know, tastes and are looking to try something new. So I think that's also helped probably with what we've done at the supper clubs, because I think people are really interested to try something they haven't had before.
Definitely. And the national dish is the fish noodle dish, which I probably completely mispronounced. Is it mahinga?
That's fine.
How would you say it?
I probably say it differently to mum as well, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, Mogengar.
I liked how you were
that's a dish that you should definitely try.
Oh, yes. And is that the dish that sort of made Grace Dent fall in love with you guys?
That was the dish she commented on.
So tell us a little bit about what is that dish.
It's a fish soup. So in Burma, you would use this type of catfish, which you can't get here. But anyway, you can recreate it with other things. And it's got lemongrass and the usual onion, garlic, ginger. And there is chili, so it's a bit spicy, but you can add more chili to your taste. So it's kind of quite fragrant with the lemongrass. And then it's got, and then what happens is you serve it with rice vermicelli noodles and then boiled egg. And then you have crunchy chana dal fritter, which really you personally, I think you always need to add that kind of crunchy texture. You kind of crumble it into the soup and it's a bit of lime and coriander. If you like, you can have a bit of raw onion and it's really nice and warming and it's dead easy to make because we make a kind of cheap version with pilchards from a tin.
That's great. A clever idea.
I think it's, I guess that twist on it is, I guess what that sort of highlights is. So when our grandma and mum first came over here, I guess is trying to adapt sort of to being able to cook the dish, but sort of adapt to what's available here. And usually you would use catfish, but they just sort of discovered that actually using pilchards worked really well. And so that's, I guess, how we've continued to make it as well.
Another clever thing about the way that you two cook is it's making things accessible. Like all of your recipes, I feel like, yeah, they're easy to recreate. That's sort of part of their charm, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's what we were trying to achieve and, you know, trying to make it easy for anyone to make it. I don't think, you know, there aren't any techniques which are, you know, really sort of tricky or anything like that. And we hope that most people are able to cook it. And you can get a lot of ingredients nowadays anyway.
Yeah, I know things have changed so much over the past few years, haven't it? So let's pause there and talk about the second desert island dish. And that's the first dish that you learned to cook.
Okay. So I know this is again sticking to the Burmese theme, but when I did think about it, I thought actually it was probably the Ono Khao Swer, which is the chicken curry noodle dish.
Ooh.
And I think that was very much from seeing mum always cooking it. And we'd always have it for celebrations at home. So we'd always have it for birthdays a lot of the time. And I think that was one I definitely started picking up more and more from mum. I'll describe it. So I guess it's like the Mogengar, it's like a bed of noodles. And you get this very aromatic coconut chicken curry that you sort of pour over and it's quite soupy. And then you put on the boiled egg and then, I guess, again, the crispy element, which is deep fried crispy noodle, which go on top as well. You mix into the bowl and it's all full of texture. And then you have, you know, again, the spice with the chili and extra fish sauce as well. And it's always a great one for sort of communal eating. So I just have a big bowl of it in the middle of the table and everybody digs in.
Oh, that's such a nice way of eating.
Yeah.
And how old do you think you were when you started experimenting with that?
I think probably at primary school, towards the end, you know. Yeah.
Because I read that both of you guys, at very young, you were in charge of Christmas lunch, which
that's quite a feat.
Yeah.
How old do you think you were when you were doing that?
I mean, I think I was probably...
I was probably old. I mean, you'd maybe in primary school, maybe I was in early secondary school.
Yeah. I think mum was happy to give that over to us.
Put her fish up for
one.
Yeah.
And what about you?
I have to say mine would be spaghetti bolognese. So, I mean, I have no idea if it was, you know, particularly authentic or typical in how it's made. But I just, it's kind of like that, midweek meal that we'd have like pretty much every week, I think. And I just remember watching mum kind of frying onions and garlic. And then obviously, and it's quite easy for you to kind of get involved and kind of throw things in and stir and brown the mince and chuck in the tomatoes. And then, you know, you can help with the spaghetti and something quite simple. I mean, I still eat it today.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the first thing I learned to cook.
It's making me think now, though, if we'd have that and then Dad would use the Parmesan on top The ones you get in the tub.
Oh, what,
you know, in the
pre-grated.
Yes.
Like, not the one that doesn't come in the fridge.
The one that goes in the cupboard.
Yeah.
Now,
how do they get away with
that? I know, I don't know how that. What is it? Inside? What is it?
I don't know. I've had it for years.
No,
that is very good.
It reminds me of that.
It's a very particular taste and smell that cheese, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so let's go back to 2013 and the beginning of your supper clubs, because I believe it all started when you went to an American-themed supper club and you sort of thought maybe that was something that you could do yourselves, but possibly a bit better.
I know, that's so strange. I think, we did go to a supper club. I think that was probably maybe my first supper club. I'm not sure for Emily, but I don't know. I think they were showcasing lots of different genres of food at the time. And I think then it got us talking about, you know, Burmese food, you know, nobody's really tasted it. And so for some reason, the conversation then led to sort of, oh, well, could we do this? And then I think we just got speaking to the organizer of the event, and he just said, yeah, okay, just like that. And we've never done anything like that before. And we were just signed up for this big challenge.
And how long did you have to prepare? Like, was it pretty soon afterwards?
I think we had a few weeks, so we could kind of test out a menu, and I don't know, he didn't know us, so there's obviously something about us that he felt he could trust, and
I trust you guys.
Thank you. Thank
you. You're very convincing, maybe.
And it was, I mean, we, because now when people ask us about, oh, they'd be interested in starting up a supper club, and I say, oh yeah, you know, maybe start with a small group at home, but no, we didn't do that. We had at least 60 covers.
Covers, yes.
Oh my goodness, for your first ever.
The first ever event. And it was three courses. It was a bargain price, I would say.
How much was it?
£15.
Wow.
And it was really intense. And obviously you learn a lot from that, kind of throwing yourself in the deep end, cooking for 60 people. And I remember, you know, there was just food all over the floor and we didn't really know what we were doing. But then he came and found us and he said, come out because some people want to meet you. So that was really nice because actually they'd had a good time. And
yeah, I mean, you don't always, you don't always go somewhere and you know, say, I want to speak to you.
No, like, that was so delicious. I need to speak to the chef.
Yeah, so that was, I think that was a surprise for us. But obviously a really lovely one. And, you know, I guess it just sort of reinforced the fact that, you know, we were doing something right and people were enjoying it. And I think that probably sort of led to us obviously doing it again and again.
Yeah, from then on, it kind of, I guess it just sort of spiraled really. And then events would sell out really quickly. And then I had a couple of maternity leaves. So we sort of had a bit of hiatus.
Oh, thank goodness that you said that. I thought you were going to say, I had some maternity leaves, had some time on my hands, and we did even more supper clubs. No. I was thinking, please don't say that. Anything like me just lying on a sofa eating donuts trying to survive. So obviously going from having only cooked for family and friends to cooking for 60 people at a go, I remember the feeling when I first cooked for people and they actually gave me money in exchange for the process, and it was a very strange feeling because you feel a bit guilty because you're enjoying it and it's fun cooking, and then you take their money and it's such a strange transaction. Did you feel like that?
I mean, it felt like a nice bonus.
I mean, I guess it's, you know, you don't end up taking up a lot of money, you know, from it. But I can't say I really felt that way, but I do feel that way a bit now, especially when sometimes, you know, our friends come.
Oh, yeah, that feels weird.
And that's like, otherwise, you know, on another day, I would cook this for you at home for free.
I mean, obviously, we can't control what they do. So they buy the tickets and you see their name and like, oh. But it's really nice. And lots of my colleagues, I think your colleagues, they book in because obviously they know what we do. And that's really nice, although it feels kind of weird. But then I think, like you said before, we're in a really privileged position. This is not our main source of income. And so that's why it's quite nice because what we've done for most of the events is then we can give that to organizations which are close to our heart. You know, some of them are in Myanmar, some of them are here. I think, you know, for example, the hospice that looked after Dad, it was really nice to be able to kind of give them something back for looking after him by doing something we enjoy. So, yeah.
I know, the fact that you guys don't make any money from this is just another wonderful thing.
We're just lucky. We're really lucky. And I don't think it's because we're like really nice people. We're just lucky.
Yeah. Well,
I think that's debatable. I think you are very nice people. I've embarrassed you now. Let's talk about the third desert island dish. And that's the best dish you've ever eaten.
So I think we agreed on this one.
Did we?
Well, yeah, I mentioned it and then you mentioned it.
Okay, fair enough.
So it must be fair enough.
This is a really difficult question because we've eaten a lot of food. Mm-hmm. In nice places, very lucky. But I think the dish I selected was the souffle at Le Gavroche, which we went there for Mum's 60th. It's her 70th this year. I'm not sure how we can top it. But it's a cheese souffle and it's light, but yet really intense. And I'm rubbish at souffle, you know,
I've never made a souffle.
Oh, no, disaster. But it's just so delicious. As part of that whole menu, you know, which is all wonderful. So we were, and that was a really, I guess it's also associated with the memory. It's like we were all together with our parents having a really nice meal.
Yes.
It was before children, so it was really calm and peaceful.
Yeah, the holiday experience. I mean, that's definitely one of the best meals of my life. I guess the other thing I was thinking, it's another French meal. This was a meal at an Epicure restaurant in Paris, which I went with my husband. And we had foie gras and brioche, which I just think is that the most indulgent thing ever?
It's a lot of butter, which is why it's so delicious.
Yeah. If you deep fried that would be...
Oh my gosh. Oh my
goodness. Guys, I think that needs to happen.
I've got a new deep fat fryer, so...
Oh, perfect. It would be a crime not to do it.
Christen the deep fat fryer.
Yes. And we had Michelle Ruon a few weeks ago, and he was talking about that cheese souffle. Oh. I have to say, I actually haven't stopped thinking about it. So
it's just amazing.
I'm going to need to taste it. Yeah.
We need to go back.
Yeah. Your mother is from Burma, so you presumably had grown up with her sharing sort of that part of herself with you through the food that she cooked. And sharing the food of your youth and your particular culture with your children is an incredibly powerful way of teaching them not only about where you're from, but also part of who you are.
She was born in Burma and she lived there until she was about 15, 16. She's a mix, so she's half Burmese, half English, because during colonial times there was a lot of mixing. I think... Obviously, her childhood was somewhat disrupted and her leaving was kind of quite a stressful time. And so food was definitely a way for her to connect with that, with her roots. And then sharing that with us was a way for us to, because as you mentioned, we didn't go to Burma till we were quite, you know, adults, so 2012. So we've grown up hearing about it and connecting with the food, but it's actually quite a long time before we visited. And she hadn't been back for sort of over 40 years at that time as well. So,
because your grandmother, she came over as well, a bit later than your mother. Yeah. But she was over here too.
Yes. So it was nice, but at the same time, it was nice to, I think, in a way for grandma, that was kind of a way that we could connect to, you know, Burma was through food, because she didn't really ever want to talk about being there because leaving had been really traumatic for them. And she just never, ever wanted to talk about it, but at least... The food was a positive thing that enabled us to connect with.
Yeah, I think that was, you know, that was really the only sort of way we could really experience it was through food initially, and maybe the odd photo. But I guess that's why when we went in 2012, it was such a big moment for all of us, including our mum. And, you know, to actually step into the country for the first time, to see everything, the sounds, the smells, everything, it was so overwhelming, but... You know, really amazing experience.
Yeah, that must have been incredible. Like, how long were you there for when you went?
So I went there a bit before because I was doing some medical stuff. But I guess overall we were probably there for about a month, at least a month.
Wow.
Yeah. And I don't know, it's just having the food that you've sort of been brought up with, but actually having it in the place and having so much more, it just adds another level, I think, to the whole experience. And yeah, we just tried so many things. And I think that probably sort of encouraged us to maybe think, you know, maybe we could do something like this at home and share more of these dishes with other people.
Yeah, because I think one of the amazing things about your childhood is that you did grow up eating so many delicious different kinds of food. So Burmese food hadn't sort of dominated your childhood or your sort of life. And then to go and to eat all of these things in, you know, even if it's exactly the same dish, how your mom would make it, sort of in the atmosphere of being surrounded by, you know, whatever's going on in the country. I think that's amazing. But it must have tasted quite different.
It does in a way. It's hard to explain or put in words.
It's familiar. It is obviously familiar, but it's also different. I mean, I think so. And I think what we'd also say is that obviously the way that our mum would cook something is probably very different from how other families would cook the same dish. I guess that's just natural for there to be some differences, but obviously it's just the same, you know, obviously it's the same sort of main components, but it's always going to be a bit different from family to family. And we probably cook it differently to mum.
You know, there will be lots of different kind of small variations in tea shops, which is, you know, kind of where you can get a lot of dishes like mohinbar, and it's open all day, breakfast, lunch, dinner, lots of dishes, and different regional variations. So you had one in the south which kind of had a different fish and had some vinegar in, and it was kind of quite different and sour. And, you know, whilst we want to share knowledge and our own Burmese food, we are totally like aware that there are so many different variations, and there's, you know, we don't own or kind of say this is the way that you must do it, because people add their little twists and variations in families and what's around, and, you know, that's a good thing, I think.
Let's pause there and talk about the fourth desert island dish, and that is, what is your favorite sandwich?
I'll go first because I know what your answer is. I'm quite partial to a cheese toasty. I'm not particularly adventurous with sandwiches, but yeah, a cheese toasty. And what is quite nice to add to the cheese toasty is something called bella ciao.
Ooh, what's that?
Which is, it's a crispy, I guess you call it a condiment, made of fried garlic and shallots and dried shrimp. I mean, there's different variations. So some people put a bit of dried shrimp, put a bit of fish or whatever, but essentially a shrimpy element and chili. And it's really delicious and Moorish, and you can have it in all sorts of ways, with rice or on the side if you've got a big spread of dishes, or quite simply on, I'm going to give this to you later, by the way, sliced white cheap sliced bread with a bit of butter, sprinkle bella ciao, that's your lunch done.
That sounds incredible.
So that recipe's in the book, but it's kind of onerous to make because it's a lot of frying. But it's worth it. And then by the time you've fried everything, it's like shriveled to this tiny ball. but you don't need a lot. You just have a little bit. And it's great. What about you, Amy? What's your favourite?
Yeah, Amy, I'm excited to hear what yours is, if it can top that.
She doesn't like sandwiches. I don't even know how often I eat a sandwich.
That's an answer in itself.
And I think then it made me think of a memory. Okay. Maybe not so good one.
Okay.
of going to school, at primary school, and always having to have packed lunch sandwiches. And Dad would make me ham and cucumber sandwiches, you know, with a cheap white bread. And he would always forget that I don't like butter in my sandwich.
How could he?
Yeah. And so I would go to school, and the sandwich would be obviously squished by that point as well in your backpack. And I'd have the butter and I just couldn't eat it.
Also, he would put a really generous layer of butter. Like, I love butter.
I just want to say that.
But you can have, you know, it would be like the, you know, almost like a slice of cheese.
Yeah, where you're like, it's even cold. And
I get it.
I'm just feeling it right now. I know.
The book, your critically acclaimed debut book. How did the idea for this come about? Had you always considered that maybe you'd end up writing a book? Did you get approached? How did it come about?
Well, it was never an idea. We never sort of dreamed of writing a book. Obviously, you know, we didn't, you know, we sort of started with the supper clubs and we're happy doing that. We never thought that we would do the cookbook, but I think it came after we had quite a lot of good publicity in the media, obviously with Grace Dent as well, and we had the piece in the Observer Food Monthly, which I think really sort of, I guess, sort of showcased what we were doing. And we were just so lucky that we were approached, I think, after that, shortly after that time. And obviously when you get offered something so amazing like that, you can't really say no.
Was it just an email that came through?
It was emails. Because, yeah, after that piece, which was really nice, and it was kind of, you know, we had like a double page spread of us.
Our faces.
Bright orange in the magazine. So I think that caught attention, and then we got emails, several emails, and I mean, I suppose it wasn't like the idea of a cookbook never entered our minds, but I don't think it would have entered our minds to actually, what's the word there?
Like pitch.
Yeah. Propose, you know, actually do anything about it. You know, I think people had asked, but you know, and the whole process, we don't know anything about. And at that time I was about to go on maternity leave, and I remember thinking, oh, this is, the timing is just so bizarre. But anyway, it happened. And the other thing that was really exciting is, you know, our book's published by Ebury, and see, you know, that's, they publish Ottolenghi and like all these
alongside
big
names. All these big names.
How can we have a book alongside Ottolenghi? This doesn't seem right. So I still can't believe that. And then we, obviously, it's with writing the cookbook, you know, there's two of us and we kind of shared that role. And actually, it was really fun and hard, but
I was going to say it was also hard. Obviously it was also hard. But
I don't know if you guys ever look at your Amazon reviews, but you should, because you basically have one negative review. And that review is only negative because the person's talking about the cardboard box that the book was delivered in.
Oh, I've seen that.
There was another review, which I haven't actually looked at the reviews for a while. There was another review that was like, there's too much garlic.
Oh. No, well, they're wrong, because you can't have too much garlic.
How is that
possible?
But isn't that amazing? Like, basically, your only criticism is Amazon.
Do we pay to write those reviews, maybe?
It's really nice. It's so, so nice. Because, you know, ultimately, it's kind of a bit of a love letter to our family, really. And
it's just a nice way of putting, I guess, everything together into
something solid
book
we can share with our friends and family and all the people that supported us.
Mm. Yeah. And then you're going to have forever. It's amazing.
I still don't believe it.
No.
Let's talk about the fifth desert island dish. And that's the dish you eat the most often.
I think this was actually, both of us agreed on this one, probably, although it might vary a little bit.
Variations
on it, but definitely curry. It's one we have every week, you know,
midweek
meal.
You need to be a bit more specific about curry.
When I say curry, obviously that does, your one will be different to my one. But yes. I would say it's often a Burmese curry, just because they're very delicious. And it's often something called a mena, which is a beef curry. And it's sort of starts off with all Burmese curries, often sort of with this triad of onions, garlic and ginger that you slow cook, particularly the onions. That's really a key point of cooking Burmese curries, and you cook them for at least 20 minutes so that they get all caramelly and delicious. And then you add your spices, and then often use beef shin, and then leave it to slow cook in the oven to develop all those flavors. And so it's really tender and melts in the mouth. And you know, curry is a great one to batch cook as well. So you cook that at the weekend, and obviously those flavors develop over time as well. And if there are any leftovers, I guess they're not actually talked about the sandwich, going back to the sandwich thing. I guess it's a half sandwich, but eating leftover beef curry on toast.
Oh, yeah, I read that your mum used to do that.
Again, it's the white slice.
The white slice toasted with the beef curry on it is divine.
Following on from your onion chat, I remember when people would come over, or like my, when I was in primary school, they would be like, I don't understand why you've got so many onions. I think other parents would be like, well, how come you've got so many onions?
What, in the kitchen?
Yeah. It's like, well, that's just the normal amount of onions.
That's like a day's worth of onions.
Because right? We do cook a lot of onions, especially with the Burmese curries. But I think the dish we most in my house would be, my husband cooks Mira Soda's mum's chicken curry from her first cookbook. We probably have that nearly every week. It's really simple, but delicious. And like you say, with batch cooking, because the way you survive, I guess, with job and children is cooking at the weekend, things that you can easily reheat during the week. So there's always going to be Mira's mum's chicken curry in the fridge.
Also, something like a curry is so perfect, isn't it? Because it only gets better.
Oh, sure. Exactly. In fact, I actively choose not to eat it on the day of cooking.
Yeah, but which is hard to do.
It's hard.
Got to have willpower. So the book is very personal. Did it feel important for you to personally to get the recipes loved by your mother and grandmother written down purely just for yourselves?
I think it's handy for my self because I do use it now. Because before it was all just very much guesswork. You know, the way that lots of family recipes, you know, a bit of this, a bit of that, very vague, add a bit more of this. And to actually write the recipes, we did get mum to make some of them whilst we watched her. And you really have to be so careful because she'll add bits and bobs when you're not watching, because it's just so kind of second nature what they're doing. But now I do use the book actually for some of the recipes I didn't make so much. How about you?
I think that is, I mean, I do, I have it on my phone. So I'm always, either when I'm cooking it, these dishes at home, or even with the supper clubs, it's quite handy because then you can just increase by, so, you know, and that helps with the amounts and things. But I do still end up doing, yeah, like changing it rogue, as well, even though rogue. It's all rich. I always like, oh, I'll just put this in it now. I'll add another garlic bulb.
But there's always add the extra garlic.
It's always actually, yeah, or the extra onion. So it's still changing.
But I do feel like with the older generations in particular, wherever they come from, they're so bad at writing stuff down. And as you say, it is all just intuitive cooking. And so we are sort of in danger of maybe losing some of those amazing recipes. So I do think it's incredible that you've written it all down.
I think it does help us now, yeah, definitely. And even still, I think about some things that our grandma used to cook. And I mean, sadly, she's passed away now, but I do have some regret over some of the things that she used to cook. And I really don't know how she cooked them, and they were so delicious. So yes, at least we have some of the things written down now. Yeah.
Right, we're on to the sixth desert island dish, and that is your go-to dinner party dish. I mean, I understand, obviously, you're full-time doctors and you're running the supper club on the side, so I don't know if you have time to do dinner parties.
Oh, yeah, we definitely do. We definitely do. I mean, I think that's the, like Emily was saying, it's the best way to sort of meet up with friends, is just to have them over and just cook for them. And I mean, the thing is, you know, dinner party dish, it wouldn't be a dinner party dish. No. Never be. I mean, it's got to be, you know, multiple dishes again and multiple puddings.
Definitely.
Because that's the other thing, is we really love, we've got big sweet things in, yeah, so we have to have lots of puddings. And so, yes, but I guess for the mains, it would be lots of things to share again. And I guess it, you know, it could be a Burmese feast with curries and salads and everything like that. But similarly, we love cooking all sorts of food. And I think one thing that I do cook a lot is often a Spanish feast.
Ooh.
As well. So I think we'd have, like, we cook lots of croquetas in my new deep fat fryer.
Yeah.
tortilla, prawns, and, you know, padron peppers and everything. Again, it's that sort of sharing element. And then, yes, finished off with not one pud, but multiple puddings.
What would the puddings be?
Well, we do love a cheesecake. We've got a mango one in the book, but we do like, you know, making lots of different types of cheesecake. You know, we've done, I guess, Basque cheesecake would fit in, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that'd be perfect.
And often it might be a trifle or something, or like a sticky toffee pudding, or endless.
What is a traditional Burmese pudding?
Well, I would say there isn't really a big thing about Burmese pudding. There are lots of sweet things, which are kind of cakey, or lots of coconut sweet things, more like snacks. I guess for us, the Burmese, what we would serve as a pudding, which I guess they would have more as a snack, is like a, it's called shui yin e, and it's you have it at New Year, and it's this coconut sweet soup. I'm not going to make it sound great, but coconut sweet soup, which you have these green pandan noodles, or I call them worms, but they're like made with mung bean flour, and they're green, like they look like green worms basically, and there is coconut jelly in there and tapioca pearls and sometimes some sticky rice, and then you have a bit of white sweet bread. So why did this bread keep coming up? Which you might think, oh, white bread in a fluid, it's going to get soggy, but it tastes really sweet, and
it's a sweet bread though,
and it's really refreshing. I hope I've made that sound.
No, you have. I'm intrigued.
There are not enough Asian, Southeast Asian desserts available to buy. I mean, obviously, if you go to Chinatown, there needs to be more.
It is a great dessert, and I think particularly in hot weather, because that's the thing, you have it really refreshing, cold and with ice as well. It's perfect.
Yeah. That's really good. Right. On Desert Island Dishes, we've got a cookbook corner. So I'd love to know, what is your most treasured cookbook?
We both have loads of cookbooks. This is a difficult one, but I've chosen the Honey & Co. baking book. And the reason I've chosen this is, well, their books are great. It feels like they're sort of just talking to me in my kitchen when I read them. The recipes really work. And obviously the restaurants are great as well. So it's really good to be able to recreate their baked goods. And during my first maternity leave, I guess, although it's busy when you have your first baby, you're kind of, there are bits of time and you're kind of, you're not working and you're looking for things to do. So I made it my mission to try and do basically all the recipes in that baking book. But it was really nice to have that to do. So I have those memories of that first maternity leave, baking lots of things from their lovely book. They're also so lovely. Mm. And they've been really nice to us and supportive of us. And again, I guess I can't believe that.
Why are they so nice to us?
I would never have imagined during that maternity leave, I'm going to meet these guys and they're going to be so nice to me. But I think you can feel that through their book, that they're just so lovely. And
you basically had your own version of Julie and Julia.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah.
Maybe that's the next film.
Yours? Your cookbook?
My cookbook?
Yeah, are you able to whittle down your collection?
Well, I think it was probably just thinking about the first cookbooks that maybe we started using when we were quite young. It's probably, obviously, Nigella the Queen. You know, she's amazing. And I think, you know, Nigella's How to Eat and all of her cookbooks, I think those are the ones which we would look at most when we were younger. And I think we still continue to use them. And obviously, you know, the way that she writes recipes is amazing. And all her food.
We even let her say Nuku Wave. Exactly. And we love it.
Exactly.
She can do no wrong. Yeah, she really can. On to the final seventh desert island dish. And that's the last dish you would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. Are you having it together?
Do you want to share?
Oh, we have some meals together.
Oh, yes, you can do it. I mean, I said...
Guys, that was very big.
I think
you can have separate leaving parties to go to the island.
You can veto some of mine. So I think to start, now you wouldn't have this.
What would I not have?
I would like, it's not very exciting, but just some really nice bread, but maybe like a...
Crusty baguette.
Crusty bread, white bread with butter. Like, you know that Bungay raw butter that you can get? You wouldn't like that.
Oh my gosh,
that
sounds...
It's really good. Bread and butter for start. Do you have a different starter?
No, I mean, I guess I would have bread and maybe something else to go.
You could dip it in some olive oil.
Yeah.
I like, some really lovely olive oil.
And then I would have roast duck, like Cantonese-style roast duck with rice. Would you
like that? I wouldn't have that.
Okay. And then I would also have moo crob from a restaurant called Singburi in Leytonstone, which is local to me. It's this crispy deep fried pork belly with chili, and it's divine. I eat it cold from the fridge the next day, but it's really amazing. And we have like two or three portions of it.
Yes.
And I would have mum's prawn curry. Would you not have that?
I would, but I'd probably have it alongside a roast dinner with all the trimmings.
Does that go fits. Okay?
It doesn't matter. This is a flexible feast. We're just going to have everything on the table.
Well, I think that's the thing. You could never choose.
I'd definitely take one of your roast potatoes.
Exactly.
And I would dip it in the curry sauce.
And that works, doesn't
it? That would work, yeah.
I mean, I think anything that we'd have before going to the desert island, it's carbs, really. That's what probably unites our answers. We have to have carbs. And a pudding.
So I said for my pudding, well, I haven't actually said, but I would have durian. Have you tried durian?
No.
It's the fruit that everyone says is really smelly. It's really delicious.
I guess that's unusual that you'd say that, to be honest. I'd say it might be at the desert island that you get put on, so don't say fruit.
Well, it's indulgent and it's very pricey. It is, like, it's not like having an apple, is it? It's rich and quite high in fat and creamy.
Okay.
Should have some to give you now.
That's true.
And I'd also have a sticky toffee pudding.
Then
I would probably die
of all that high fat.
Yeah, but you've got a lot of time to digest.
Exactly.
What's your pudding?
I would have to say a sticky toffee pudding or like an apple crumble, custard, you know, cream, clotted cream.
Right, let's have all of those.
Yeah.
All of the above. Yeah. Are you happy with your choices?
Yeah.
Would you rather have them separately?
Actually, no. We just like a bit of each other's as well.
Okay.
We'd get jealous.
We'd share. So, we'd be okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Emily and Amy, those are your desert island dishes. Thank you so much.
So there we have it, another delicious day of Desert Island Dishes. Don't forget that if you enjoyed today's episode, you can rate and review the podcast on iTunes and even subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And it really does make such a difference. It boosts the show in the charts and helps others to find it, which is great and means that I can keep bringing it to you each week. If you don't already, come and follow me on Instagram at Desert Island Dishes, and you can sign up for the newsletter and find a whole host of different recipes at desertislanddishes.co. Thank you again to our sponsor, Cook's Matches, and I will see you next week. Thank you so much for listening. Bye.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Anish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.